so much for being with us today here on the Morning Tailgate. It's a Thursday. Clay Baker, Vinny Bonsignor, and you, 702-365-9200. Text the word FREE, F-R-E-E, so you can qualify for this week's Summer of Fun Wyoming Adventure out to Alpine, Wisconsin. You don't want to miss it. Text the word FREE for your chances to win that vacation or the $3,000 cash. It's up to you here on Raider Nation Radio. Case Kiefer joins us now here on R&R 920, assistant sports editor and writer with both the Las Vegas Sun and the Las Vegas Weekly Magazine, a weekly magazine that is free everywhere throughout Southern Nevada at all PTs, Terrible Herps, newsstands everywhere, including right outside Lotus Broadcasting. Here with us today, Case, thank you for joining us and good morning to you. Real busy week here in Southern Nevada, but you know, during this week we're taking a look at Raiders opponents, especially division by division, going through the league and taking a look at the NFC South today, which looms large for the Raiders because that's a big division for the Raiders in schedule. But towards the end of the year, after the bye week, three teams on the schedule are NFC South teams, including Atlanta, New Orleans, as well as Tampa Bay. What did you think first about New Orleans now in their second year with Derek Carr? And we kind of been doing this discussion on, all right, well, what more do you expect from Derek Carr, especially if we keep using the word, well, maybe if this works or maybe if that works, Derek Carr could be in for a big year this year. How do you find Derek Carr now in this season with the New Orleans Saints, with everybody riding on this team to make and clinch that division and get into the playoffs?
With the Derek Carr conversations, but no,
it never ends.
great to be with you guys, and yeah, excited to talk some other NFC South, which I think overall it's a good division to draw. I think it's one of the weaker in the NFL. I don't have super high expectations for any of them, but I think the flip side of that is I don't think you love drawing the New Orleans game at New Orleans at the end of the year, because I actually feel like I am probably a little higher on the Saints than what I've heard most people that are kind of sick of this same conversation where, you know, whether it's Derek Carr's fault or not, I don't need to toe into that, where, you know, every year it seems like he's on the same type of team that's fighting for their lives at the end, never really pull away no matter how much talent they have. But I think that kind of memory is kind of overshielding how much talent is on the Saints team. I think they were the best team in the division last year. They had some things break against them. I think they were a little unlucky not to win it. And, you know, I know the Falcons are kind of the flavor of the week now this year going into the NFC South, but I still think the Saints roster, you know, top to bottom, probably is a little bit better than theirs. So that's a tough game to have at the end of the season, where I think the Saints will certainly be fighting for something. And if everything goes right for the Raiders, them as well, that's the one I'd circle as the toughest one.
Let's assume Kirk Cousins is going to be healthy this year for the Falcons. A little bit of a tall task coming off the injury that he had, but by all indications, he's on his way to being healthy for this season. How much of a difference does he make in Atlanta? And if he is healthy, where do you put the Falcons in terms of the hierarchy of that division?
Yeah, I mean, they're right there. I think I'm leaning the Saints just a little bit. I like they have a little more continuity. And like I said, I think top to bottom, they have just as much talent. But, he should be huge. You get why they did it, certainly. They just last year, it seemed like they had a lot together. I know the defense kind of underachieved by the end of the year, but I mean, weapons wise, they have some guys out there that I think kind of make the rest of the league jealous. You just have to have someone to get it to them. And you look at what Kirk Cousins has done year in and year out. He certainly looked like a solid candidate. And if he's even, if he's close to what he's been at his best, I think he's a good fit there, and it makes sense. I still am a little worried. I mean, an older guy coming off of a really serious injury, installing a new system. I don't necessarily think they're just going to fly out of the gate. So they're kind of seen as a runaway favorite in this division. And I don't know. To me, that's making a lot of assumptions. So I didn't dislike the Kirk Cousins signing, but I'm also not just 100% ready to sign off. But this is, one of the teams to beat in the NFC.
It's Case Kiefer here with us on Raider Nation Radio, the Morning Tailgate. Follow him on X, at Case Kiefer. When you think about the Tampa Bay Bucs, though, we were going through projections last year, and we remember how not a lot was expected of what Tampa was going to do, and perhaps they were even thinking about a rebuild, and maybe Baker Mayfield would be looking on for another team because he was on a one-year deal. But they posted 9 wins. How fluky was that, or was that based in fact when you take a look at the overall of how the Bucs were able to ascend into the playoffs?
I think it was pretty fluky, to be honest. I mean, not entirely fluky. Of course, there are some things they had to do right, but I think I just said the Saints, I felt like, had a lot of bad luck. You know, some crazy things go against them in close games, some turnover luck that went against them. And I feel like the Buccaneers benefited from a lot of that. There's always a flip side. And I think another thing, and I know it's not, you never want to pin it on one guy or whatever, but I think Dave Canales is just so huge. I think he really worked around kind of their shortcomings on offense. I think he worked was able to scheme past an offensive line that was one of the worst in the league talent-wise, and they did play better too, so credit to the guys up front and the offensive line coaches. But I think it's a really big loss that he's leaving, and not only leaving, but leaving to another team in the division. This isn't, you know, the typical defending division champion to me. I'm going to need to see it again, as I just have more questions than answers with them right now, and I do kind of expect a precipitous drop-off this year.
I know we're gearing up for training camp for the Raiders in Costa Mesa here in a couple of weeks. How soon do you think we're going to be given word or indication, or whatever the case might be, on who the starting quarterback for the Raiders is going to be in 2024?
I still think it'll be a couple weeks into training camp. I think the Raiders, you know, maybe even later than that, maybe after a preseason game or something. I think they really expect someone to claim this job. Now that they have a little bit more familiarity with the offense, they've you know, gotten to be around a little bit. I think the excuses are falling off a little bit, as in terms of not being at your best. So I think the Raiders truly believe that one of these guys is going to show out at training camp and claim the job. So I wouldn't say super soon, but I don't think we'll be waiting till it. Didn't someone, or maybe it was college, didn't name their starter to like the kickoff of week one? I think it'll be before that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and nothing like waiting until the last minute just to, you know, just to get that the element of surprise in there. But, you know, we even took a look at some betting odds in global books yesterday, and Gardner Minshew, for quarterback competitions, which quarterback would win the job? And of all the five teams that may have presumed quarterback competitions, it's obviously the closest race is here in Las Vegas with the Raiders. Minshew was listed in a global book at -130, and it was +100 for Aiden O'Connell to win starting job for week one. What do you think either one of those guys have to prove in the preseason and during this portion of camp to show that they are the better of the two?
Yeah, it's wild. I think we talked about this before, but I still just go back. I remember the first time I saw those lines, Gardner Minshew, was like a -400 favorite. I think there was a, you know, kind of a feeling around the league, at least, maybe not locally as much, in people who knew how highly the Raiders thought of Aiden O'Connell, if this was Gardner Minshew's job to lose. I thought that was way too high. I thought it should have come down. Did come down. Now, I don't know, just betting on the what we've seen over the years, the experience, I think maybe at that short of a price, I'd probably lean Minshew. But we'll see. It's an interesting conversation to have for sure. And excited to see what each of these guys can bring out of the other, and who ultimately steps away with it. Because I really believe this is a competition. I really think you can convince me it could be either one of them.
Three players that you are fascinated about seeing and watching and observing during training camp for the Raiders.
Who I got to go Brock Bowers. I know that might be kind of a cop out, because you know, the number one overall pick, or the first round draft pick, is always going to be a lot of eyes on that. But I think just some of the things we saw him do in minicamp, I mean, he was pretty exciting. He thought a play would be dead, he'd somehow get open, and Gardner Minshew, at least the time I'm remembering off the top of my head, found him. So I think he's always going to be a guy you want to watch. I guess sticking with the same theme, Tyree Wilson has to be in there. You have to hope you get something more out of him this year after using the number 7 overall pick. Where does he kind of fit in a defense that to me is kind of set? And, you know, you've got a lot of playmakers. You really need him to be in the mix. And then I guess I'll cheat since you said three players, but I think the other competition that looms so large is that other outside starting cornerback spot. Yeah. So I guess Jacorian Bennett, if I had to pick one, see what kind of leaps he made. I think Brandon Faison's a little underrated and could be probably the favorite in that competition, but we'll see if Jacorian Bennett can chase him down, maybe.
I was just going to ask you, yeah, what would be, like, if we put up a theoretical betting lines on who's the other outside corner, and would you put in Jacorian Faison or maybe one of the two rookies? Or maybe an other, maybe something out of free agency?
I think this would be a lot like the quarterback one, how I said it moves so much after mini camp and OTAs. I think from the buzz I had been hearing about Jacorian Bennett and you know, the strides I think the team expects him to make, I think he would have been the favorite coming into the practices we've seen so far. But I don't know if I remember right in what I saw. I feel like Faison is getting a little bit more run with the starters. I think he is a little bit more of the safe option. So to me, I would make Faison a very slight favorite, maybe like -150, Ja'Quarian Bennett coming back at like 2-1. And then the other guys, I wouldn't rule out of it. I mean, Richardson for sure really looks the part. Looks like he's physically ready. So, but still, you know, as a rookie long shot, he's got to be like 6 or 7 to 1. And then, as a seventh rounder, I think Devin Shire, even longer, maybe 10 or 12 to 1. That's my bookmaking on the fly. I don't think we have a high hold percentage there, but that's off the top of my head.
That's pretty crazy. That's awesome. Do you think that the weather factor in Costa Mesa compared to what it would be here in Henderson for those 2.5 weeks or so, do you think that there's going to be some value to the Raiders working in that kind of weather compared to what they would have faced here in Henderson?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's going to allow them a little more flexibility with the schedule. I feel like they felt like they were boxed in the last several years just with how hot it got, that they needed to practice early enough that they could beat the heat a little bit, and then that kind of affects everything else the rest of the day. I think now they can they can schedule things based on when they think it's most beneficial, that they don't have to think as much about the weather. So yeah, I think that is the I know it depends who you ask what they say, but I think that's really the number one reason why they wound up in Costa Mesa, and it makes a little bit of sense to me.
I mean, can you imagine if they didn't make that move, what the storylines would be already this time of the year, when you know it's getting like national coverage on record-breaking temperatures in Las Vegas? How are they going to have an NFL team practice and training camp out here during all this? You know, that would have been a story.
That's true. I hadn't even thought about that. Perfect timing by Tom Telesco and Antonio Pierce. Yeah. We need to look into it. Either of them have a meteorology minor or something. I don't know. There's might be something there.
It's something special to behold, because it's actually a projection that they did have. And while we're speaking of projections, and we've already done a little betting, can I throw this at you? There were some season stat props for both Jakobi Meyers and Davante Adams on over-unders for receptions, receiving yards, and touchdowns. Can I give a little taste, get your thoughts?
Let's do it. I haven't looked at them at all, so you're truly getting my just off the cuff.
Okay, good. Just go over under. I'll give you, it's Davante Adams on receptions, 90.5 over under.
Ooh, good number. I'll go over, though.
All right. Davante Adams, receiving yards, 1,050.
It's correlated. I went over with the reception, so I guess I got to go over with the yards as well.
All right, fantastic. Okay, Jakobi Meyers, receptions, 69.5, over-under.
I'm going to go under. I think he was a good player. I like what he did last year, but I'm not 100% sure how he's going to fit into this offense, so I'm selling on Jakobi, if anything.
Yeah, because there's a little more mouths to feed at that point. But what about Jakobi Meyers' touchdowns, 4.5, over-under?
Oh man, that we did see him become a kind of a red zone target last year. I'm pretty sure he went over this last year, but 4.5, that's a good number. Again, my correlated mind just works. I already went under the other thing, so I'm going to go under here, too. I'll say he gets 4.
Oh, beautiful, man. Okay, very good. You're off the hook there. Hey, what do you think about, by the way, in the Las Vegas Sun, Case Kiefer here with us. I loved your interview with Andre Arlovsky from the UFC, the former great champion. What was that like to talk to him after all these years?
Yeah, I mean, it's wild. I started covering MMA at the UFC. I think the first card I went to was 2009, maybe 2010.
Oh, yeah.
So now I feel like I've been around more than anyone when I go to these events or go down to the UFC. And, yeah, that sometimes you meet someone that's been there since UFC 28, and you remember that you're kind of still new to it all comparatively, too. It was cool to catch up with him after all these years. It's just pretty amazing, a guy, you know, deep into his 40s, still fighting, a guy that's fought under 3 different ownership banners of the UFC. I feel like there's a constant churn of fans in mixed martial arts, and there's been a whole lot of new ones, of course, with you know, their recent prominence on ESPN, Conor McGregor, Ronda Rousey. So, you know, no guy has a better sense of how the sport has changed and seen it up close than that former champion Andre Arlovsky.
You know, you brought it up in the Las Vegas Sun on the today's article about the NBA Summer League. It's hard to believe, also the 20th anniversary of the NBA coming here and spending its summer, and now where it was just a small exhibition has now turned into an absolute showcase where Vegas is prominently on ESPN and NBA TV for 10 to 12 days. What are some of the things that you want to watch for, and something that has the most intrigue for you for this 20th edition of the Vegas Summer League?
Yeah, it's wild how it's grown. I think just that first night, usually it's so well attended, and I know tomorrow night. I'm really excited to see what kind of crowd the Lakers draw with Bronny James and Dalton Connect playing here. I think that's going to be a wild scene. So I don't know. I like all the competition more than everyone too. So I'm excited to see who ends up getting to the playoffs and the championship. I know no one else really cares, but we'll go first things first. I can't wait to see the crowd at Thomas and Mack tomorrow night.
Hey, they're still giving out championship rings for the summer league. I know a lot of people laughed at that, but I'm cool with it. If you win a championship, you ought to be able to celebrate and get something for it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote about this in that piece, and the thing that sold me on it is the players actually did care. I think some people mocked them, but like the first year they were doing it, the Trailblazers were pointing at their fingers during the game, and it really did mean something to some of those guys. Some of these guys who've been fighting to get into the NBA for years upon years, so I think it's cool they make it a little bit of a spectacle for those guys.
That's great stuff. Case Kiefer here with us, Las Vegas Sun and Las Vegas Weekly Magazine, at Case Kiefer on X. Thank you again for your time. Case, let's do it again next week.
All right, good talking to you guys. Thanks a lot.
Great to talk with you. Thank you, Case Kiefer, here with us on R&R 920. And it goes to show you that, even if you try to put, something that's like a trophy at the end of a year after, the NBA Summer League, you're getting almost every team participating in it. It does mean a little something because you're rooming together for the first time. A lot of these new players, there's maybe first or second year players that are coming back. Also, they're trying to gel as a team, and it's not lost on these organizations. If you've not been to one of these summer league games, execs are there, GMs, coaches, sometimes assistant coaches are really going to be coaching the team, but that doesn't mean the rest of the teams aren't there. It is absolutely packed. The stands are packed with team members and executive staff. Everyone takes these things very seriously because they want to observe where this team's headed and how quickly are these guys going to have chemistry.
Well, and as a player, you should take it seriously too. And there's good habits that can be built and curtailed and developed even in summer league. You remember Robert Horry, right?
Yeah, big shot Rob.
Yeah. I don't know if you know this, but he walked off the court at an ABC camp. What do they used to call those? The ABCD camp, I think it was,
Wow, I haven't heard of that in a long time.
So check this out.
Yeah, it's been a while, right?
So check this out. So, and he and I talked about this, and he got a bad rap out of it. There was a couple of prominent college basketball, analysts that ripped him for. It was during one of those camps, and they have scrimmages all day, and he just literally walked off the court, and they called him selfish for doing that, right? And years later, when I talked to him about it, doing a story on it, he was like, "The irony was, I walked off the court in protest for the style of play that was being played." He goes, I'm a role player. I'm a guy that rebounds, passes, defends, does all the little things. That's what my game is predicated on. That's how you win basketball games. And in those showcase events that they were having, it was just all guys trying to get theirs, right? Trying to score a bunch of points and everything like that. And I just finally got fed up and I walked out because I didn't like that style of play. And I looked like the selfish one when I was in protest of the selfish type of basketball.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
And it was, and he just has remembered it all his life. He remembered all the pontificators or the analysts that criticized him, not knowing what was in his heart and what he was actually doing. It was actually for a good reason. Like, this isn't basketball. This is one-on-one BS out here. And I think when you put something like this, where there's something to play for, some recognition, a ring, whatever the case might be, you get your name up there on the banners, it reaffirms that you're not out here just trying to get yours. You're trying to win some games because those are habits that translate into the NBA. I remember Alex Caruso saying this one time, how players can escape or graduate from the G League to the NBA. And he's like, you got to understand that where we are in the G League, teams are looking for custodians. Teams are looking for role players. They're not looking for the CEOs of the team. The CEOs of the teams are the LeBron Jameses and the Carmel, he's naming all the top players. Here, what they're looking for is, can you come and contribute to a team like that? Do the contributing things that are needed. So a guy can average 35 points a game in the G League and be a guy that the NBA is just like, no, that's not, we're not really looking for that. Great, you're doing that here. You're shooting the ball, X amount of times a game. But are you doing things that help a team win? Are you playing defense? Are you passing the ball? Are you doing the right things at the right moments? And that's what they're looking for. And Caruso understood that and just played his game, didn't score a whole lot of points in the G League, but did things that help winning teams win basketball games, and that was recognized. So things like that in the summer league, if you're in tune to what – now, you obviously, you've got your Victor Wembanyamas and guys that are going to be superstars in this league also playing in here, but there's the majority of the guys that are on the summer league – that are on summer league teams – are looking to find role player spots on teams, whether it's here in the United States or overseas. And so if you're contributing to a winning team, you know, that's going to help you further your career. That gets recognized. And so giving somebody a ring for playing the game the right way to try to win games here and not just showcase yourself, I think is a positive thing.
No, it is. And you'll see that a lot in these games. And it begins on Friday, 11 days, 76 games. You can get your tickets at 739fans or unlvtickets.com. And Cute Myers will be broadcasting live on Friday from the Thomas and Mack Center. And you'll see coaches asking players to do specialized things in certain regards because they want to see, can you, you know, how well are you as a rebounder? Can you be an offensive rebounder? Are you blocking out? Are you doing what we're asking to? Because some of these players, you really want to find out, can they run to coaching? Can they absorb what coaches are telling them? That's a big factor in a lot of these guys, either if it's a rookie or it's a second-year player coming back and also trying to find a role. Like, are you able to really soak up what the coaches are asking? Because we need to find the guys we're going to roll with right now.
Yeah, and you look at Bronny James's stat line yesterday. It wasn't like this over... He's not going to be an overwhelming player in the NBA. Mm-hmm. You know, when you get drafted 55th, you're kind of going to... You're top of the line projecting as a role player in the NBA. And if you looked at his line yesterday, he filled it up with all the good things that you need players to do at that level, right? You know, the role player type numbers. And somebody asked LeBron, you know, about the statistics and the scoring and everything like that. He basically laughed at me. He was out here in Las Vegas. Like, that's not what this is about. It's about development. It's about getting better. He's going to spend pretty much all this year in the G League. He's not going to, I doubt very seriously, you're going to see a lot of LeBron, of Bronny James with the Lakers, unless he's doing things at a high enough level that they feel like he's going to be able to contribute. This will be a year. A lot of second rounders, you know, fit into this category where you're down there in the G League developing your game. There's plenty of time for Bronny James to develop into a solid role player in the NBA. And I think that's what the Lakers' vision is for him. Yep. I think Bronny James understands that. I think LeBron James understands that. So if you're judging Bronny James as some player that's going to be his father, you're looking at it completely wrong, and you're just setting yourself him up for failure because no one's going to play like LeBron. LeBron James isn't going to be LeBron.
And I think over the years, LeBron has been, you know, helping his son understand those expectations.
Yeah.
And you're not here to be in my shadow to try to outdo me. You have to find your way in the league. That's
right.
How difficult this place is.
And there's the way basketball is set up right now with their salary cap structure and the two aprons and the severe price you have to pay as a team when you go over those those salary cap thresholds and how much you have, the penalties that are involved, the financial penalties, it's debilitating. Mm-hmm. So you need to figure out ways to maximize your roster with players that are unselfish, that do good, solid things, that do it on an inexpensive way, along with the high priced players that are on the roster. You have to figure out that model, and more of these role player type players are flourishing now in the NBA. The NBA has gone away from just collect a bunch of superstars. That model doesn't work, and financially, it's really hard to do. So you have to develop young players and young skills that are going to be able to help contribute to winning. I don't know that it's going to or not going to happen with Bronny James, but for anyone to say that it's not going to, I think it's completely missing the boat. How do you know? Just let it play out and let him develop, just like any other second round pick is gonna develop, and see what the Lakers or whoever ends up getting a hold of him, what they ultimately have over the balance of his career.
Yeah, you can see it all unfold for yourself beginning on Friday night for 10 days. It's awesome. You buy a ticket and you're there inside the Thomas and Mack and Cox Pavilion. You can watch every game for that date purchase. 739 fans and at unlvtickets.com. Here on Raider Nation Radio, we'll step aside. We also have Ash the attorney, Ash Watkins from Sam and Ash Injury Law. We'll do a little street legal at 9:45. Here on Raider Nation Radio, we'll come back with some thoughts on the Atlanta Falcons coming up next here on the Morning Tailgate.
Hey, Clay. You know what? 10% of $9 billion is?
10% of nine bill?
Mm-hmm.
Nine mil?
900 mil.
900 mil. Okay.
We're talking billions here, Clay. Yeah, it's easier to add another couple zeros to that. So the NFL, and we're going to get into this as far as the money goes, and there's a point to what I'm saying. But anyway, just a couple minutes ago, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell did an interview with, I think it was CNBC. And anyway, he indicated that for the first time ever, the NFL is now open to potentially allowing private equity firms, not individuals, but firms, Blackstone, you know, groups like that, to purchase up to 10% of NFL teams. Previously, you know, like they would allow private equity stakes and teams to be sold to somebody like a Tom Brady,
yes,
or, you know, individuals,
mm-hmm,
not groups. But now,
because individuals can be easily controlled or worked at, groups are different.
Yeah. And, to be clear, when you purchase, whether it's a individual or a firm, which looks like they're heading in that direction, when you purchase a minority share of a team, a minority stake of a team, you get nothing other than maybe a plaque or some recognition. You get to go to the games, you know, but you have no decision making ability, nothing. You have no seat at that table.
Strictly an investment.
It's an investment, which is it's a good investment, because as teams' values rise, your return grows, right? And that's why Tom Brady wants to do what he's doing. But it's hard to find individuals that can come up. We just said $900 million for a 10%
stake. Of a
$9 billion a team that's valued at $9 billion. That's what the Cowboys are valued.
Mm-hmm.
So good luck finding a Tom Brady or somebody that has $900 million to buy 10% of the Dallas Cowboys right now, individual, right? However, if you open it up to a Blackstone or equity firms like that have groups and money, you know, put in groups, that's a lot easier to do. So now it's going to make it a lot easier for teams to literally turn paper into money. Imagine being able to just say, yeah, you could have 10% of my team at $900 million. I get the cash. You get a nice plaque. And teams will, I think groups will do that. The NBA, I think, allows up to about 30%.
Yeah, now is the time for the NFL to do it.
Right, exactly. So that just kind of came down the pike. The league hopes to get that all resolved by the end of the year. Now, this doesn't affect the Tom Brady purchase or Richard Seymour, who seems to now be a part of that. They're individuals,
mm-hmm,
that are buying into the Raiders, that are proposing to buy into the Raiders. But down the road, whether it's the Raiders or the Rams or anyone else, you can definitely see some of these owners saying, yeah, I can use a little bit of extra cash right now and just turn part of my team that's paper into real money and real wealth. This is going to make this a whole lot easier. I will say this.
Yes.
You always got to be careful, though, on who you kind of let in. Because once they get in, crazy things can happen.
It's easier to vet one person versus a group of 12.
Right, and so you have to be aware of what their real motivations are. But it just always drives home the fact that money is so important. And even owners that have $9 billion or teams valued at $9 billion. Look at some cash and say, yeah, I could use that $900 million right about now. And we're all in that situation to some extent or another, maybe not $900 million, although that would be great to find under the Christmas tree one year. However, maybe you're in a position where you need $500 right now or $5,000 right now, and maybe your credit cards are maxed out, or maybe the credit isn't where it needs to be. Don't worry, because for over 20 years, the experts at LendingStore.com have helped millions of people who needed cash quickly, and all credit types are welcome. Now cash is as close as your phone and as soon as tomorrow. When you need cash, you need it now, so why wait? Head over to LendingStore.com. Let them help you find somebody that can help you get that $500 to $5,000, a lender that can help you get that money as early as tomorrow. Just go to LendingStore.com.
We were absolutely exasperated at the last 20 minutes of the flurry of activity on the text line. It's a good thing Friday's coming up, because for our mail call segment that will begin the Friday show, we have a plethora of thoughts here. And I've never seen a guy more divisive and polarizing than a guy like Derek Carr when it comes to Raider Nation Radio. All right, as we were talking about, what is average to you at the quarterback position, and where does Derek Carr fall in line with that? Felix Duran from the 702 says, Derek Carr, average quarterback. And I was a Derek Carr fan. I am a Derek Carr fan, but he always left me wanting more, and he couldn't give more because it just wasn't there. If your objective of every team is to win the Super Bowl, now in the NFL you need an elite quarterback to do so. It's sad to say Derek is not elite, but until then, I'll be rating him average at best. And then right on the heels of that, good buddy Jason in Maryland says, what frustrates me with you two is that you use the talent of the team around the quarterback as an argument when it suits your narrative. Carr was not Joe Montana, but the talent around him was subpar at best, probably six of those 9 years, and defense completely trash. Carr was throwing to old-ass Jordy Nelson and Brandon LaFell 1 year. Brandon
right, well,
LaFell,
whatever, but,
Jason,
but,
that's so funny. I love it.
All I know is they went to Cincinnati, and he threw for under 60% of his passes. All right, so mm-hmm. didn't we talk about how the Saints defense was number, what, seven
yeah.
in the NFL this year?
Not too shabby.
That's not a bad defense.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't play well in certain situations, and he just didn't play well enough. And he was thought of as the missing piece last year for the Saints, and he didn't deliver. Everyone's rooting for Derek Carr. I like Derek Carr a lot, but I'm just being honest. So where would you say? What was it, Jason in Maryland?
Yeah, Jason in Maryland.
So what is he to you? Is he an elite quarterback in the NFL?
Yeah, if you were able to rank him, text it in, Jason.
Yeah.
Where do you rank him now?
Yeah.
After all these years, because there's plenty of sample size to work with.
Middle of the pack is 15-ish, 16-ish. That's where he finished last year. That's where he's kind of typically is in the NFL. Derek Carr has put up some pretty good statistics, but there are also times in certain parts of games, in certain parts of the season, against certain opponents, where he just doesn't play well. Mm-hmm. And he throws, bad interceptions or turns the ball over. That's statistically, provable. We've seen it. And so, to me, when you look at an elite quarterback, you have to take the whole thing into account, and when you really need your quarterback to play well, did he or didn't he? And there's times over his career where Derek Carr just didn't play well when the Raiders needed him to play well the most.
Jason, thank you for that, as well as Felix. In fact, everybody from Fabian to Hot Sauce and Napoleon, Dennis, we will put all of those texts into the mailbag for tomorrow morning. We'll start the show with that. It's important that you bring us these great thoughts. And everybody who texted in today, we'll make sure that we travel it on into tomorrow's show. It's Vinny and Clay here on Raider Nation Radio. Coming up next, it's Street Legal with Ash the attorney, Ash Watkins from Sam and Ash Injury Law. And we'll start it off on that crazy story from the NBA betting scandal, including Jonte Porter. That's next. Next.
Back to the Morning Tailgate with Clay and Vinny.
All right, you hear the music. It's not the people's. It's time for Street Legal with Sam and Ash Injury Law. If you are hurt in a crash, you call Sam and Ash at 702-303-0333. And Ash is here with us right now, as she is on Wednesdays at this time. Thank you so much for being with us. I know it's a Thursday. Thanks for making a flexible change in your schedule. I got to ask you, though, especially when it comes down to this crazy story about the NBA betting scandal with Jonte Porter, where he admitted that he schemed to take himself out of games for gambling's sake, pled guilty to a federal conspiracy crime in a scandal that got him banned from the league. All right, so he's free on bond. Estimated that his sentence could be 3.5 years in prison to a little over 4 years. It'll be up to a judge. But I got to ask you a question. When it comes down to this, Ash, how does a judge actually decide prison time when it is such a broad range that someone could serve maybe up to no time to maybe even up to 20 years? How does a judge decide that?
Yeah, great question, Clay. It's not arbitrary. You know, these judges, what will often happen is sentencing hearings, which are little kind of mini trials where the prosecutors will make suggestions to the judge on a specific range that they think is appropriate based on everything that's gone on, the crime committed, the facts behind it, the specific defendant and his life and his actions and involvement in the crime. And then the defendant, he will put on his own evidence of why he should get less time. There's various mitigating factors, as we call it. And then the judge will evaluate both sides of that hearing, and they will pick a number that they think matches the defendant's conduct.
Because this is a case that doesn't have a whole lot of precedent to it, so a lot of different factors have to go into it. But I was also thinking on the other end, where he's an NBA player, he's trying to take himself out of games, so he his relatives or their friends could then go and take that information and place, you know, large bets on that particular athlete's performance, if they do well or do they do poorly. So how are these other people that are involved in this conspiracy, they have yet to enter pleas. How do you decide, like, you know, with their factors as well, because they're a part of the actual crime being committed? You know, somebody who might be kind of like, you know, sloughing off on a game, what is the bigger crime here, those who are betting on that or the player himself?
Ooh, I don't know. You know, that's interesting. Bigger. I think they're both problematic and both challenging to accept in any way, because they impacted the outcomes of games and other people's bets and gambling efforts. So, I can't say one's less wrong than the other. But I ultimately, my belief is that part of Jonte's plea deal was cooperation with respect to these other individuals who were placing these bets. And that's why the prosecutors, one of the things that you negotiate with your plea deal is what the prosecutors will recommend. You know, they'll go before the judge and say, hey, judge, you know, we've got this no time up to 20 years, and we're going to suggest somewhere at 3. You know, that's something you bargain for when you're negotiating plea deals.
All right, you've had a lot of experience. We're speaking with Ash from Sam and Ash Injury Law. Follow her at Ash the Attorney on X, as well as Sam and Ash Law on X. When you think about guys and women who plead guilty for certain charges, they own up to the wrongdoing. They put it in the decision's hands of the judge versus a jury. What is the overall success rate of those who plead guilty in cases like this?
Well, success rate, I mean, with getting the plea that they want?
Yes, yeah, success rate in getting the plea that they want. They're not getting out of it, but perhaps to a lesser charge or to perhaps lesser time. How much does that factor in on that, especially with other cases that include those who plead guilty?
Yeah, I mean, look, the criminal justice system has a lot of the same prosecutors going up against the same defendants. So a prosecutor will not be successful if they're getting plea deals based on and then not getting them entered, like they, right. Then they'll not get it. So that if they start getting a bad reputation, like if you plead guilty, I'll go before a judge and get you 3 years, and they're not succeeding in those recommendations, then they're not going to be able to make future plea deals with those same defendants. Because look, lawyers, it's a small community. We talk, we make and negotiate based on what we know is likely to happen. And also, these defense attorneys, they're not going to advise their client, or they shouldn't advise their client, to accept a plea deal that they know is unreasonably low and not likely to go before to succeed in front of a judge. So it's complicated, but you know, we as lawyers, we've got reputations, and it's imperative that we maintain them. And part of that is dealing with one another fairly and reasonably.
That's Ash Watkins with Sam and Ash Injury Law. If you're injured in a crash, call Sam and Ash, 702-303-0333, available in both Nevada and in California. And, you know, there's something that stinks in northern Nevada, and this time it's not Reno. It's Lake Tahoe. As authorities, I know, I mean, it's like they just leave themselves open, you know. But it's either Carson City or Reno that's on my list. Tahoe beaches are now testing positive for toxic blue-green algae. It's blooming, and it's something that, you know, in this state, they really try to protect everything they can with Lake Tahoe, or seemingly they do. But here's the problem. There's an investigation of people on social media claiming that their dog died because of algae poisoning. There's people getting sick. You know, those microbacteria are very dangerous, and they seem like we kind of take them for granted because we feel like, you know, amoxicillin is going to take everything. But is there a potential for, you know, this kind of algae to be deadly? And also, what's the responsibility of local law enforcement or even the state, that, for example, to close a beach until tests come back that it's safe?
Well, yeah. So, look, I mean, our parks and lakes, and that's part of tourism, and so that generates revenue for our state, for California. And look, the Lake Tahoe is run by the federal government. Mm-hmm. It's a okay. U.S. entity, so they're in control and managing it and making sure it's safe. But I mean, look, California and Nevada, they have a vested interest too, because tourism, you know, that draws people into their respective states. But who's responsible? What caused it? Did someone dump something in there that caused this algae to bloom? What knowledge of it already existing did anyone have?
That's like,
did
I'm
the
saying.
Federal government, did the Park Services, U.S. Forest Services know this algae existed in high quantities, was dangerous, and didn't do anything until now, didn't even put up a warning? Well, that becomes problematic. But look, I get it. They put up a warning, until the testing comes back. And then if the testing comes back with toxic levels, then they will likely shut it down. But again, that's tough to enforce.
If an autopsy proves that either in somebody who has died or perhaps an animal, a pet that has died, that they find that kind of a high rate of toxicity in the body, who then now is responsible?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like I said, it's then tracking how did it get there and who knew it existed. Did something artificial get put into the lake by a company? You know, did a company go in, dump some barrels of some sludge and cause this? Well, then you'd go after the company. But otherwise, if it's just a naturally occurring thing that happens when the ecosystem gets out of whack, that's going to be tough to prove that someone was responsible for this loss of life unless they knew it existed and was there and they didn't do anything to prevent harm.
Right, because there's constant testing, especially if it's a federally protected piece of land or lake. Hey, there's constant maintenance, there's constant water tests that have to be done, and if it's not being done in kind, then that definitely falls in a federal government's hand, and some agency dropped the ball. Hey, Sam and Ash, Injury Law, we absolutely love it on Wednesdays at 9:45. Thank you, Ash, for being a part of it today. SamandAshLaw.com and 702-303-0333. If you're injured in a crash, call Sam and Ash. Ash, I hope you have the best weekend and get in a pool and have some drinks. Well, yeah, stay out of the heat.
Swim safely, guys.
Yes, I expect to see you with a drink in hand and a pico de gallo in the other. That's how I expect this.
Oh, there we go. Love it.
Thanks again, Ash. Have a great day. Find all our podcasts up online at lvsportsnetwork.com. For Vinny, I'm Clay. Have a great day, everybody. Rich Eisen is next, then JT The Brick Show at noon. Q Myers from 2 to 5 here on R&R 920.